Okay, folks, as Ian said, we're at the end of a series on Joseph, and that brings us to the end of the book of Genesis, and we'll be finishing with that series today. But at the end of Genesis from chapter 48, we see Joseph now in a position where God has used him to deal with a famine in Egypt, and as a result of what Joseph was able to do with God's help, he has rescued the whole nation from famine, and with that nation, the people of God. His father, Jacob, who became Israel, and his brothers, Joseph's brothers, who of course are the children of Israel, are now with Joseph in Egypt. They've moved there with him. And Jacob has reached the end of his life. Joseph's father has reached the end of his life. And now he is able to bless all his sons. He has all his sons around him, including Joseph and his sons. And he is able to bless them. And he is able also to arrange for his own burial. What a change at the end of Genesis we see in Jacob. In chapter 42, we hear him saying, "Everything is against me." What had happened there was, as far as he knew, Joseph was dead. His brothers had told the father he was dead and sold him off into slavery. So Jacob thought Joseph was dead. And he'd sent the brothers into Egypt to get food where there was food. They didn't know it was Joseph that was distributing the food. But when Joseph saw them, he said, "You're going to have to leave one of your brothers here, Simeon, and you must bring back Benjamin with you, otherwise you won't see Simeon again." So they go back to Dad, they go back to Jacob and say, "This leader in Egypt has kept Simeon and we've got to take Benjamin with us." And we read in Genesis 42, their father Jacob said to them, "You have deprived me of my children. Joseph is no more and Simeon is no more, and now you want to take Benjamin. Everything is against me. Everything is against me." But now, at the end of Genesis, he's with Joseph. He's with Joseph's children. He's with all his sons. He's blessing them. And he says to Joseph, "I never expected to see your face again. And now God has allowed me to see your children too." What a change there has been in him. If only Jacob had known. If only he had known what God was up to during those dark, sad days of tears and loss and disappointment. If only he had known what God was doing and how God was at work when he was saying, "Everything is against me," he would have felt so different, wouldn't he? Joseph also now can see the purpose and plans of God worked out through his own trials and difficulties, which, as we've seen, has been many. And when Jacob died, his brothers thought, "We're in for it now. Now Dad's gone." So they go to Joseph and they say, "While Dad was still alive, he said, you must, you know, forgive us." And Joseph says this to them. But Joseph said to them, "Don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. So then don't be afraid. I will provide for you and your children." And he reassured them and spoke kindly to them. So they can now all see that the providence of God has been in action. Now they're able to look back and see that God was there all along. And we are meant to be encouraged. We are meant to be strengthened to trust the same God to be at work in our lives, no matter what is happening. I know that is a massive statement. I know we have issues amongst us today that are huge, huge issues. But this is what we believe. This is what the Bible teaches. This is what this message is all about. We are meant to be encouraged and trust this same God. In Romans chapter 15 verse 4, it says this: "Everything that was written in the past, including this story of Joseph, was written to teach us so that through the endurance taught in the scriptures and the encouragement they provide, we might have hope. So we are meant to read this account and in our lives endure and be encouraged and have hope. That's what these incidents, these stories are recorded for. And it's not just the history that's there to encourage us. We're meant to read this history and say, well, if God did that there, he must be working now as well. It's not just the history. We have clear, explicit statements. The New Testament says things clearly and positively to us, like Romans 8:28. And we know that in all things, God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. We know that in all things, nothing is left out of that. I said before, I know, friends, I know that some of you are facing incredibly difficult issues. But if words mean anything, words mean anything. Paul says, in all things, God works for the good of those who love him, of those who have been called according to his purpose. So, Jacob and Joseph, they're now sure. They can see it. Oh, yeah, God was in it all along. God was there. God was working all the way through it. So, can we be sure that providence is at work in our lives? Can I be sure in my life and in the confusion and in the mess and in the strange things that happen? Can't wait for next week's story. Just can't wait. But in all these things that happen, can we be sure that God is at work in our lives as well? Well, one famous description of providence is found in chapter 5 of something called the Westminster Confession of Faith. And this was written in 1643 after the Civil War, and Parliament had called together a group of ministers and said to them, right, we want you to work together. We want you to come up with something which will give us an understanding of what God wants from us, of how we should govern the church, how we should organize things, how we should rule things. And this group of ministers spent 5 years and they came up with the Westminster Confession of Faith. Now, this is not one of those things. We're going to look at one little section of it in a moment. I want to be as clear as I can about this. I know it's hot, but you're going to have to really think this morning. I want to be as clear as I can about this. This is not one of those things that you must believe in order to be a Christian and be right with God. Yeah? There are some things which are essential. There are things concerning who Jesus is and what Jesus has done, which if we differ on those, then you're either in or you're out. That's all there is to it. But there are other issues. There's no unimportant issues, but there are other issues where there's room for discussion and opinion. And I'm giving you this morning, not because I'm saying you must believe what these guys said, but because it is the thought-through position of gifted men who loved the Bible, believed the Bible, studied the Bible, and spent their lives preaching the Bible. This is what they believed about the providence of God and God being at work in our lives. So, there we go. So, this is just two of the statements. It goes on quite a bit further in chapter 5. But this is what they said. God, the great creator of all things, does uphold, direct, dispose, and govern all creatures, actions, and things, from the greatest even to the least, by his most wise and holy providence, according to his infallible foreknowledge and the free and immutable counsel of his own will, to the praise of the glory of his wisdom, power, justice, goodness, and mercy. Although in relation to the foreknowledge and decree of God, the first cause, all things come to pass immutably and infallibly, yet by the same providence, he orders them all to fall out according to the nature of second causes, either necessarily, freely, or contingently. Okay, this is there. They talked together. They looked at the scriptures together. They set it down in words as clearly, as concisely, and as precisely as they could. This is what they said. And let me just draw out some statements from this, okay? You might be looking at that and thinking, what on earth is that saying? Well, here's some of the things it's saying, okay? And it's saying that God upholds, directs, disposes, and governs. God is in control, that's what it's saying. He is not just on the sidelines watching it all happen. God has not just created everything and then left and watches from a distance and goes, oh no, what a mess. Oh dear me, look at that, that's going on. God is in control. That's the first thing they're saying. They say that this applies to all creatures, everything living, and all they do, as well as things that do not have life. So God's control applies to everyone, every living creature, even things that aren't living, and to everything that they do. They say this: it is true of the greatest, whether people or events, as well as the seemingly insignificant. So I can't read this story of Joseph and say, well, you know, God was at work in Joseph's life. God was with Joseph. Of course he was. Joseph is in the Bible. He's important. But what about me? Who takes any notice of me? You know, who cares when I fall over or when I miss the bus or when something goes wrong or when things go haphazard in my life? It applies to the greatest as well as the seemingly insignificant. And he does this, he organizes this in ways that are always in line with his wisdom and his holiness. And that is based on the fact that he knows without any chance of error all that is going to take place. So God knows everything. Everything that has happened, everything that everybody's thinking, everything that's going to take place, God knows it. And all that happens will be in accordance with his own free and unchanging will. And it will all bring praise to his glorious wisdom, power, justice, and mercy. Now, seen from God's position, all this happening, seen from God's position of knowing everything and deciding everything, it all happens perfectly. Seen from God's position. Seen from our position and the fact that God uses second causes, God doesn't do everything himself, people and things happen. Seen from our position, things happen either necessarily, freely, or contingently. Necessarily just means the laws of nature. Some things happen necessarily, okay? So you don't have to go to bed at night thinking it's gone dark, what's going to happen next? Wonder what comes next? What might happen? Well, you know, it goes light again, doesn't it? Necessarily. So some things happen in that way. Some things happen freely. I make decisions unconstrained by anybody. Yeah. For instance, this afternoon, up to now, I don't know what I'm going to do because Marlene hasn't made my mind up. So things happen necessarily or they happen freely. Yeah, we just make decisions freely. And then things happen contingently, yeah? So what happens in some instances depends on what goes before. You might be planning to have a barbecue, but you probably said to your friends, we'll have a barbecue, but if it rains instead, we'll do this. So some things, what happens, depend on what goes before. Even though all that is true, some things are necessarily happening, some things freely, some things contingently, God, by his providence, is still in complete control. There's a great illustration of this, I think, in the Bible where Paul is a prisoner on his way to Rome. He's in a boat on the sea, obviously, and he's on his way to Rome, and there are soldiers there, there are other passengers, and he knows there's going to be it's clear the weather's bad, it's the wrong time of year to be traveling, but the sailors and the Romans insisting on carrying on, and he's saying it's going to cause trouble if you do. But that night, God speaks to him. And God says to him, I'm giving you the lives of everybody on this ship. Everybody's going to be safe. And by now, the sailors are scared to death. They're trying to get in the lifeboat and get off. But Paul stops them. He doesn't let that happen. And the boat is in a terrible, terrible mess. But God has made a promise. And some things happen necessarily. Yeah, you've got a wooden boat. You've got a rough sea. You've got sand and what do you call it when you've got you've got, you know, they're near the shore, yeah? Sandbanks and things like that. Okay, yeah, wooden boat, rough sea, wind blowing, sandbanks. What's going to happen? The thing's going to break up, isn't it? It's just obvious. Something's happened necessarily. Something's happened freely. Some people are diving off thinking, I'm going to swim for it. Other people are thinking, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to wait and see. I'm going to hold on. And so something's necessarily, something's freely, something's contingently. If that big wave comes just as that person is jumping and it hits them, but if they jump just afterwards, yeah, it all depends. All of those things are taking place. It looks like chaos, yeah? It looks like chaos. Some people are holding on to bits of wood and eventually they all reach the shore. Some of them coughing and spluttering, you know, and somebody looking on would say, "Poor, that was lucky. That was lucky. No, nobody lost their lives in that." But God had said that that is what would happen. And that, I think, is a picture of what we have there. Now, there are lots of scriptures that caused these men to think and explain things in this way. David collected lots of things for the building of the temple. And when he'd done that, this is what he says. "Yours, Lord, is the greatness and the power and the glory and the majesty and the splendor. For everything in heaven and on earth is yours. Yours, Lord, is the kingdom. You are exalted as head over all. Wealth and honor come from you. You are the ruler of all things. In your hands are strength and power to exalt and give strength to all." Now, most of us here are used to coming to church. Most of us here are used to language like this. And so we stop. We don't even think what it really means. We just hear the language and we think, oh, it's church talk. It's worship talk. Yeah. But David is saying, yeah, the kingdom is yours. And what he says is, you are the ruler of all things. And when David said that, he meant it. He meant, God, you are the ruler of all things. Nebuchadnezzar didn't think that. Nebuchadnezzar was the ruler of Babylon, and he was so full of himself. One day he said, he looked over Babylon and he said, "Look at this, look at my kingdom that I have built." And the scriptures say that God struck him, and Nebuchadnezzar ended up living like an animal, eating grass. And it was, I think it was 7 years or something like that. And this is what Nebuchadnezzar said: "At the end of that time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes toward heaven, and my sanity was restored. Then I praised the Most High. I honored and glorified him who lives forever. His dominion is an eternal dominion. His kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the peoples of the earth are regarded as nothing." Nebuchadnezzar said this. He does as he pleases with the powers of heaven and the peoples of the earth. No one can hold back his hand or say to him, "What have you done?" There are loads of other scriptures, and I've listed many of them, and there isn't time. But just jump into Ephesians chapter 1. Paul says about God. He says, "This is in accordance with the plan of him who works out everything in accordance with the conformity." Sorry. "The plan of him who works out everything in conformity with the purpose of his will." Now, if words mean anything, Paul believed that God was in control of absolutely everything. On a personal level, the first time I was faced with these issues was when someone gave me a book to read. And in the introduction to this book, this person kept repeating the same question. And I had never thought about this question. I was only a young man, but I was involved in Christian things. But I'd never stopped to think about this question. But he just repeated this question over and over. And the introduction began with this: "Who is regulating affairs on earth today, God or the devil? That God reigns supreme in heaven is generally conceded. That he does so over this world is almost universally denied." And he was talking about Christian believers, not just about the world outside, yeah? "Who is regulating the affairs on earth today, God or the devil? That God reigns supreme in heaven is generally conceded. That he does so over this world is almost universally denied." And then he looked at every sort of area you could think of: the material realm, world affairs, the church. And he kept asking the same question. And I would suggest to you that we need to stop. It's great to sing and worship together. It's great to encourage each other. It's great to pray. It's great to do all of these things. But at some point, we have to stop and think and say to ourselves, who do we believe is in control? Who do we actually believe is in control? Is it fate? And not a week goes by without somebody mentions fate to me. As if there's some blind, unconcerned, uninvolved force and things just happen by fate. Karma. Again, because of the places I go to and the people I meet, I'm told about karma. How that, you know, you get what you deserve, you do good things and good things come, you do bad things come. Is it fate? Is it karma? Is it chance that's in control? Is it just luck? You know, are things just a question of luck and chance? Is there a battle going on? You know, is God struggling? Is God almost overwhelmed, but he's just about managing? Is that what's happening? A preacher from the 19th century called Spurgeon, this is how he described it. I believe that every particle of dust that dances in the sunbeam does not move an atom more or less than God wishes. That every particle of spray that dashes against the steamboat has its orbit, as well as the sun in the heavens. That the chaff from the hand of the winnower is steered as the stars in their courses. The creeping of an aphid over the rosebud is as much fixed as the march of the devastating pestilence. The fall of leaves from a poplar is as fully ordained as the tumbling of an avalanche. A current preacher and writer, R.C. Sproul, I'm not sure how you say his name, but there we are. He says this, if there is one single molecule in this universe running around loose, totally free of God's sovereignty, then we have no guarantee that a single promise of God will ever be fulfilled. And a theologian called Loren Boltner said this, although the sovereignty of God is universal and absolute, it is not the sovereignty of blind power. It is coupled with infinite wisdom, holiness, and love. And this doctrine, when properly understood, is a most comforting and reassuring one. Who would not prefer to have his affairs in the hands of a God of infinite power, wisdom, holiness, and love, rather than to have them left to fate or chance or irrevocable natural law or to short-sighted, perverted self? Those who reject God's sovereignty should consider what alternatives they have left. So Spurgeon, Sproul, Boltner, they all believed this stuff. They would have agreed with the guys from the Westminster Confession of Faith. But then there are the trees that you can see from the cafe in Asda Living at Elk Mill. When I'm sat in that cafe while a certain person is shopping and I'm just reading a bit, I glance up and I look out the window. And one day I noticed this row of trees. And I remember counting them. Obviously, I can't remember the number now. But it was at least 15. It might have been more. 15 trees. And all the trees had branches, believe it or not. And all the branches had twigs, and all the twigs had leaves on them, and they were full of leaves, and the wind was blowing, and everything was just going all over the place in this massive row of trees. And I was thinking, what about, I can't see it, but what about that one leaf on that 15th tree, on that branch down there? Does God know what's happening to that one leaf as it twists and turns? Does he even care? Is he concerned? Does he have enough power? Is he able to deal with that? What does being infinite really mean? Now, this I know that this concept is too much for many genuine Christian believers, and I'm not quite sure how to deal with it, but I do understand that for some it's too much. But I would suggest to you that if we believe the Bible, then certain things we have to believe, yeah? I'm not saying you've got to believe all of that, but I'm suggesting to you that if we believe God's word, how can we not believe this, these statements, that God knows? Whatever's going on, God knows. Whatever you're going through, God knows and understands. He has the power. He has the power to deal with whatever is happening. He cares. He never stops caring. He is wise and he is holy in everything he does and in everything he allows. And whatever is happening, and I go back to what I said at the beginning, some of us are facing massive issues, but whatever is happening, the very least you can say about it is that he has allowed this to happen. He is in control and he can use it for good. That's what the story of Joseph teaches us and tells us. Often the hardest part of the difficult times we go through is the feeling or the temptation to give way to the idea, this is just random. It can feel meaningless and pointless and without purpose. Things are just happening to me. I'm like a cork on the sea and I've got no control and nobody knows and nobody understands. Nobody can do anything about it. That's how it can feel. And there's a temptation to give way to that feeling. But that's like finding ourselves in a hole and digging it deeper. This statement from the Psalms has really helped me, and I've prayed this statement over and over again. This is what the psalmist said during a hard time. I will cry out to God Most High, to God who performs all things for me. I will cry out to God Most High, to God who is in control, to God who performs everything, to God who deals with everything. I don't know what's going on. I don't understand. I can't see what the outcome is going to be. I don't know if it's going to be something that I would ever want or cope with. I don't know. But I'm going to cry out to this God who is Most High because he is in control. If that is true, then I would suggest to you that our response should be one of trust, dependence, and resignation. We are to trust this God. The Bible's full of statements about trusting in the Lord, about putting our hope and our trust in him. We are to depend on him. We are to find our strength in him and turn to him when we feel that strength is lacking. And resignation means we give ourselves to his control, to his purpose. There's a psalm that says, "My times are in your hands." My times are in your hands. A friend of mine who was dying, and whenever I went to see him, he always wove that into his prayer as we prayed together. My times are in your hands. This is true. If all of this is true, and I believe it is true for myself, I believe that this is true. But if it's true, why do I struggle? Why do I struggle? Why am I not 10 times the man that I am? Why? Why? When it rains on me on a day out, do I take it personally? Why? Why when things go wrong, do I say this shouldn't be happening? Why? Why when I believe these things? Why do I struggle as I do so much? This is what I believe. I believe that I am made right with God through faith in who Jesus is and all that Jesus has done. I am 100% accepted as I am with all these faults and failings and fears and worries. I am accepted. I have come into God's kingdom. I'm a believer. He's at work in me. He's given me love for him and he's given me limited, but he's given me an understanding of spiritual things. He has changed me, but the job isn't over yet. God is at work. There is a process in me of growing and developing that trust and that faith. And that's why I struggle. And what I need is more. That's what I need. I need more. I need God to open my eyes more. A few weeks ago, Neil read to us from Ephesians where Paul was praying for believers that he knew that needed more. And he said, "I never stop praying for you that God will open your eyes so that you will see. So that you will see and so that you will know the hope to which he has called you, the riches that are there for you, and the greatness of God's power that is at work in you. I'll finish with this. There's a story in the book of Ruth of Naomi, who, with her husband Elimelech, leave the land of Israel, God's promised land, because there's a famine, and they go and live in a pagan country, Moab, a godless country. And Elimelech dies. Her two sons get married, but 10 years later they die. So she's left without a husband, she's left without sons. And she sets off back to the land where she used to live. And the two daughters-in-law want to go with her, but she says to them, "Don't you come. There's nothing for you where I'm going. Don't you come." She basically says there's nothing there. And this is what she says to them: "It is exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." One of the daughters-in-law goes back. But Ruth says, "Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people. Your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. Where you, and there will I be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates me from you." Ruth says to Naomi, who has just said, "It is exceedingly bitter for me. The hand of the Lord has gone out against me." Ruth says, "Your God, this God, is going to be my God." Yeah? Now, I know that we need to present to people the best picture of being a Christian that we can. Yeah? I know that we need to be happy and confident and strong people, and well, we need to be honest as well. I understand that. Are you with me? Do you get what I'm saying? But here was a woman who'd just been told, the testimony she heard wasn't, "Oh, I'm saved, everything's great, it's fantastic, why don't you come with me, it's amazing." Naomi's saying, "You go back to that pagan land where you came from. God has dealt bitterly with me." I believe Ruth had learned, she was married to a man who knew God. I believe she'd learned about this God. She'd learned about the way he dealt with these people. She knew that this was no God to mess about with. She knew that you didn't get your own way all the time. She knew that things didn't always go right. But she knew that this was a God who was in control. This was a God who was holy. This was a God who was wise and loving. And she said, "I'm going with you. Your God is going to be my God." Let me finish with two questions. How big is your God? How big is God in your understanding? However big you imagine God is, he's bigger. He's bigger. How much do you think God loves you? How big is your God? How much do you think he loves you? However much you think he loves you more. He loves you more. The answer to either of those questions, how big God is and how much he loves us, I genuinely believe this. I genuinely believe that we couldn't take the answer, yeah? That our minds and our emotions and our hearts would not cope. I genuinely believe this. I genuinely believe that it would kill me. It would kill me if God revealed to me the true extent of his greatness. It would be too much for me. But believe it or not, because I've experienced something of it, I also believe that were he to show me the depths of his love, I wouldn't be able to take that either. I wouldn't be able to take it. That's why Paul says, "I'm praying that God will strengthen you so that you will know." You need to be made stronger to cope with how much God loves and cares for you. However you feel right now, whatever you're going through, maybe you're feeling that someone or something is out to do you harm. May you be able to say with Joseph, "You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good."